Mr. Mayor, and other distinguished guests and ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here in Western Sydney, a region which accounts for roughly one in every 15 jobs in Australia. I noticed on the table that we've been given these nice little first aid kits. I thought I'd bring it up here for question time. I'm not sure what the message was that it was on the table, but anyway, I have it with me. Of course, events far from Western Sydney can affect all of us through one channel or another. And so in light of the recent events in Europe that you've all read about, I thought I would spend some time talking about those matters, what they might mean for Europe itself, for the rest of the world, and of course for us. I should stress at the beginning that it's quite early days to make an assessment of that, and so things I'm going to say will be very preliminary in their nature. But to begin with, what I'd like to do is give some background on how the global economy has been travelling over the past year or so. We estimate that world GDP grew by about 1%, or maybe even just a little above 1%, in the March quarter of this year. That follows a similar pace of growth in the two preceding quarters. And that, in turn, followed a contraction in the global economy that happened in the first part of last year. This recent growth, I would note, has occurred with, to date, very little contribution from the euro area. In fact, in the euro area, demand has been going backwards already over the past 6 months. Now, many forecasters have penciled in a rate of growth for the world economy of about 4% for 2010. That is to say, they've expected that the rate of growth that we've already been seeing for about 9 months will continue through the rest of this year. If that occurs, that outcome would be at or even slightly above the average pace of global growth for the 10 years up to 2008 before the crisis occurred. That's not just the Reserve Bank's forecast, though we would broadly concur with it. The IMF, the OECD, various private international forecasters have numbers like that. There are some who are more pessimistic, there are some who are more optimistic, but generally speaking, about 4% annual growth for the global economy this year is what you could call a consensus number. It's worth noting that if that turns out to be the answer, that it would be a considerably better outcome than was generally expected a year ago. In fact, for most of that intervening period, the bulk of commentators, I would say, have been worried by so-called downside risks, that is, the possibility that things will turn out worse than had been expected. In the event, though, it was the upside risks that have materialised, at least over that period. That is to say, things have done a bit better than had been expected. Why is that? Well, one reason might be that in the wake of the crisis at the end of 2008, virtually every country moved their economic policies very strongly in the expansionary direction. So not only was the global downturn rather synchronised, so was the policy response, and that's, in fact, unusual in history. In countries whose banking systems have not been impaired, and that's actually most countries, those policy reactions have had a considerable effect on economic growth, a positive effect. And those effects are amplified by the spillovers which occur because everybody is doing this simultaneously. Yet the upswing is still uneven. It's been very strong in Asia and South America. There were some figures from Brazil just last night, very strong growth in that economy, and likewise around most of the Asian region. It's been moderate, really, only to date in the United States, though I think starting to gather a little more momentum now. And it's been quite weak overall in Europe. Even within Europe, there's quite a mix of growth performances across countries. It's of some considerable importance to Australia that the strongest growth in demand around the world has been quite nearby. Most of the economies in the Asian region, Japan aside, have experienced the classic V-shaped recovery. In fact, it's one of the steepest Vs that you're ever likely to observe in that economic data. Some of that recovery reflects the process of restocking of goods around the world, but a lot of it is in fact driven by demand within the Asian region itself. Commodity prices generally rose somewhat after the big fall in late 2008. With particular significance for Australia, though, prices for those resources which go into the making of steel, coal and iron ore have rebounded very sharply over the past year. For iron ore in particular, which is a major export for Australia, contract prices at the moment are double what they were a year ago. Until recently, spot prices in the market were well above that level even, though they have retreated a little just lately. So in short, growth in the global economy, although uneven, has occurred in the form and in the places which were most likely to give a terms of trade benefit to Australia. I should perhaps define what I mean by the terms of trade. That's the ratio of the prices for our exports compared to the prices of our imports. And you can think of that as a measure of purchasing power of our export basket. So when our terms of trade rise, as a nation, we are richer. We have higher income. And this year, it looks as though our terms of trade will once again reach the 50-year high that they saw in 2008. Now, it could be that some of that gain is not permanent. Some of the countries in Asia will probably, one way or another, experience some moderation in their growth rate over the coming year, if only because the pace that they've seen in some cases can't really be sustained without problems arising. The Chinese authorities in particular have for some months been seeking to take some of the steam out of their economy, and they may be having some success at the moment, particularly in the area of housing prices. So for that and other reasons, we and many forecasters assume that this level of our terms of trade, this 50-year peak, won't be sustained indefinitely, though we do think a fairly high level will be maintained into the future. And to reach that 50-year peak twice in 3 years, well, that tells you that there's something more than just a cyclical event going on. And it's increasingly apparent that the Asian region is becoming large enough to have its own independent and quite tangible effect on the global economy. Let me give you a few figures to illustrate that. 20 years ago, in 1990, China and non-Japan East Asia combined accounted for 9% of the world economy. By 2000, that had risen to 14%. In 2010, it's likely to be about 20%. China is already the world's largest steel producer. It's the second largest user of oil after the United States. China's share of global GDP could exceed that of the euro area in 5 or 6 years from now. So that confluence of events, which is quite profound in the long run, actually, will, I think, see an acceleration in the shift in perceptions about the shape of the global economy and the global financial system. The prominence of Asian views and the weight accorded to them are likely to grow accordingly. What Asian policymakers do and say increasingly will matter in the future. Turning then to recent events in Europe, it's worth asking at the beginning how these countries arrived at the position they find themselves in today. This story is actually quite nuanced by countries, and so we don't want to generalise too strongly. But broadly speaking, the public debt in Europe relative to their annual GDP has always been actually a little on the high side through much of history. It's tended to ratchet up every time there's an economic downturn, and then efforts to get the debt down again in the good times have had only modest success, really. And so cumulatively over 30 to 40 years, the ratio of debt to GDP in these countries has tended to keep rising. For some countries that joined the euro area 10 years ago and that enjoy a substantial fall in the borrowing costs for their governments as a result, well, really that in a sense masked a certain vulnerability, because to some extent their fiscal sustainability depended on being able to keep borrowing cheaply. When you think about demographic trends, and they're quite pronounced in Europe, some countries already have declining populations. Well, that makes this problem more acute, because a high debt burden is more easily managed by a country where the number of people and the size of the economy, therefore, is growing, like in Australia, say. It's much harder when population is static or declining. So this problem was slowly but steadily accumulating over 3 or 4 decades. And then the financial crisis occurred. There was a very deep recession, and recovery from that is not yet entrenched. Budget deficits rose as a result of that, reaching 10% of annual GDP in some cases in Europe, and for that matter in some countries outside Europe. Well, the prospect of adding 10% of GDP to the debt stock each year for just a few years, that actually makes a difference to assessments of sustainability, even for a strong country. For the not-so-strong countries, financial markets began to signal unease, and so borrowing costs for those countries began to rise. That, of course, makes the problem worse, because it impairs the fiscal balance further, and so on. Well, initially, the effect of all this on financial markets was very much confined to Europe. Wider effects were observed in May, pretty soon after we said that at this point things have been confined to Europe. Within a few days, they no longer were. And global investors became more cautious. We've seen that in the various events in the past month or so. Uncertainty over the nature of the policy response in Europe, fears that it could be uncoordinated across countries, and things like that saw a marked increase in financial volatility in share prices and exchange rates and so on, and our markets have been affected along with everyone else. Now, qualitatively, some of these events had a certain feeling a little bit like the September-October 2008 period about them. Quantitatively, though, they have at least up to this point been nothing like as pronounced. There are various indicators of stress that we look at, and they haven't signalled anything like the stress that we saw after the Lehman failure in September 2008. But of course the episode isn't over yet, and these issues will continue to need careful handling by the people concerned, directly involved, and close monitoring by the rest of us. So what have the European authorities done? Well, they've assembled a rather large support package, some hundreds of billions of euro, which covers Greece, but also, if needed, other countries too. It's got a few elements. Firstly, it provides financing support at a European-wide level for individual countries, if needed. That relieves them of the need to go to the private capital markets for a while. Of course, it's subject to conditions. On top of that, the European Central Bank is undertaking some operations to stabilise bond markets, and it's ensuring abundant liquidity in money markets, standard response to these kind of problems. The International Monetary Fund has committed to be part of the financing as well, and it will play, as it always does, an important role in ensuring that the conditionality associated with this lending is met. And the final element, and a crucial one, is that governments in Europe have committed to reduce budget deficits and therefore control the future rise in their debt, even though debt will still keep increasing for a few years. Now, that's the basis of it. A lot of detail is still being worked out and some yet to be announced. Well, at the moment, any assessment of what all this means for economies is highly preliminary. One might expect some effect on business and household confidence, but it's too early yet to have much data in the countries concerned to evaluate that. Looking ahead, we would have to think that the planned fiscal contraction that is going to occur will act, at the margin at least, to dampen spending and therefore economic activity in Europe over a period of a few years. Now, fiscal consolidation has always been planned, and so that should have been built into the existing growth projections, but some countries in Europe, a number of them now, are planning to consolidate their budgets faster than earlier assumed, so some of this dampening impact will come in sooner than had earlier been expected. Now, of course, there could be an alternative fiscal path where they didn't do that, where they didn't take stronger steps to address budget deficits and so on. The problem with that might be that in the current climate, that would carry some risk of a loss of fiscal credibility for these countries. And if that occurred, that would probably be followed by a more serious crisis that would push up borrowing costs quite sharply for the governments concerned and therefore for the private borrowers in their countries. And that would damage growth a lot. So the task here for our European colleagues is to find a credible fiscal path that steers between these two rather difficult and unpleasant alternative bad outcomes. And that task has gotten more difficult in recent times. So over a horizon of, say, a couple of years, it's hard to see how euro area demand won't be a bit weaker than earlier thought. And other things equal, that would lessen the rate of growth at the margin for the global economy next year, more than this year, but most likely some effects next year. That said, those projections weren't relying a whole lot on much strength in the euro area anyway, but nonetheless, this will act as a bit of a dampener, other things equal. Of course, in the real world, other things never are equal. Other things change, and it's important to try to keep those in mind. Financial markets will respond to these developments. Policymakers in other regions may respond to them as well. For a number of countries, the core European countries and some of the other major countries not in Europe, these events have actually pushed down the long-term borrowing costs for their governments and therefore the base on which private borrowing costs rest. Well, that actually, if it persists, and it may not, but if it does, helps to lend a little bit of support to growth in those other countries. If policymakers outside of Europe respond to these developments by leaving their expansionary policies in place longer than they otherwise might have, that too would act as a certain offset to what's happening in Europe. So a number of other things might change, and that makes it hard to be definitive on what the net impact is ultimately going to be. What about effects on Australia? Well, commonly in these sorts of events, people go and look at how many exports we send to Europe. And the answer to that is that only about 5% of Australia's exports go to the euro area. That's not that big. And those exports have tended to be fairly weak anyway for a few years now because the euro area itself has had weak demand over that period. So that effect may not be all that large on us, but it's usually the case, actually, that the most important effects on Australia don't come through that channel. They come from the broader global channels, the impact on global growth, particularly the impact on Asian growth, which is important to us, the impact on resource prices, our terms of trade and so on, and the impact on the cost and availability of global capital. How big those effects turn out to be, we can't as yet know. That remains to be seen. One thing we can say, though, is that in these sorts of episodes, one of the key advantages you can have is a good starting point. Now, there's an old joke, as you know, how do you get to such and such? Well, I wouldn't start from here, is the old joke. We're not starting from the same place that the Europeans are in this episode in many dimensions. Australia's budgetary position is very different from those in Europe and, in fact, better than in most countries. Public debt is low, not high. Budget deficits are under control and already scheduled to fall over the years ahead. The banking system is in very good shape. It has little exposure to the debt issued by the European sovereigns that are having the problems. And in fact, the asset quality of our banks, generally speaking, is better today than they had generally expected it would be. The flexibility afforded by having a floating currency, as we do, coupled with credible monetary and fiscal policies. These are all advantages in a period of heightened global uncertainty. That doesn't mean that we are unaffected, but it does mean that we're in the best position to ride through the episode, even if it was to get worse. Well, that said, I'd like to pose one final question, and that is, if we step back from the high-frequency flow of events in Europe and ask ourselves, is there a lesson that we might take away from having observed what they're going through? What would that lesson be? Well, I think that certainly one observation you could make is that vulnerabilities in economies can remain latent for a long time and then suddenly materialise very quickly. Financial markets can happily tolerate for an extended period something that's a weakness without much reaction and then suddenly react very strongly once some trigger event occurs. Now, in the case of Greece, if we took that, there certainly were some revelations about the true financial position of Greece being much worse than people had earlier been told. So that was genuinely new information. But more broadly across Europe, it can't really have been news that there was an issue about fiscal sustainability. That's been the case for a long time. But governments didn't come under gradually increasing pressure from markets to fix that. They came under very little pressure, actually, for quite a long time. And then the pressure became intense after a trigger event, in this case, the economic downturn. So it follows from that, I think, that potential vulnerabilities need to be addressed in the good times, even when markets are not signalling concern. Because by the time markets do start to signal concern and start responding seriously, whatever that problem is might have gotten rather large by then. How then is that relevant to us here in Australia? Well, we don't have a problem of public debt, as I said, nor do we have a problem with corporate debt. There were some highly leveraged corporate entities which foundered over the past couple of years, but for the most part, corporate balance sheets going into this episode were strong, and they're even stronger now, in fact. The big rise in debt that we've seen in Australia in the past 20 years is in the household sector. Now, there have been many reasons for that, some of them suggesting that it made perfect sense for households to take on more debt. And overwhelmingly, households have serviced that higher level of debt very well. If we look at the arrears rates on mortgages, to take just one measure, they remain now very low by global standards and pretty low actually even by our own past standards. And Australia's always had low default rates on mortgages by global standards. And so that's helping to keep the asset quality of financial institutions very high. So just to be clear, my message is not that the run-up in household debt we've seen so far is in itself, you know, a terrible thing. That's not my message. But that doesn't mean that it would be wise for that build-up in household leverage to continue unabated in the years ahead. One would have to think, surely, that however well households have coped with recent events, and they have coped well, further big increases in indebtedness would increase their vulnerability to shocks in the future, a shock like a fall in income, which could happen if the economy was hit by something that caused a downturn from outside. And so further big increases in indebtedness could increase vulnerability to a greater extent than would really be sensible. Actually, I think that many households may have sensed that. We do see, and this has been frequently remarked lately, a certain caution in their behaviour. Even though unemployment is low, consumer confidence has been quite high. It's come down a little bit lately, but still actually is in reasonably good shape. Despite all that, consumer spending has seen fairly modest growth over the past several quarters. Now, that's perhaps partly attributable to the way the fiscal stimulus measures at the end of 2008 drew forward spending on consumer durables into that period and out of the period we're in now. That's probably part of the story. But I think that even beyond that, what we're seeing is that the long downward trend in household saving rate, that seems to have turned around. And we're witnessing, I think, a little more caution in borrowing behaviour, even apart from the effects of the recent increases in interest rates. So it could be that there's something rather more deep-seated and fundamental happening to household attitudes on spending and debt. Now, we can't be sure, and if it is happening, we can't be sure whether that will continue. But if it did persist, and if that meant that we avoided a further significant increase in household leverage in this cyclical upswing, well, that might be no bad thing. Moreover, if a period of modest growth in consumer spending helped us to make room for the build-up in investment activity that seems likely in the years ahead, well, perhaps that would be no bad thing either. That sort of behaviour would surely increase the medium-term resilience of households and accommodate the resource boom and the rise in other forms of investment with less pressure on labour markets and on prices than would otherwise occur. Well, time to conclude. The world economy has, to date, staged a stronger recovery than most people thought likely a year ago, albeit one that is uneven across regions. When we look ahead, past this year into next year, it has to be expected, I think, that the unfolding situation in Europe, which is going to mean earlier fiscal tightening than had earlier been assumed, will weigh somewhat on global growth next year. But the overall outcome will still depend on what else happens, and judgments about all that at this stage can only be preliminary. It can't be denied that the potential for further financial turmoil exists, but to date, at least, the stresses there have not been of the order of magnitude that we saw 18 months ago. Much still hinges, however, on the way European policymakers craft their response to what is a very complex problem. In Australia, of course, we need to naturally keep a careful watch on all of that. It will be just as important, though, to keep a close eye on what happens in Asia. Asia will be affected by what happens in Europe, but also by its own domestic forces. The experience of the past few years certainly is that those domestic factors, good or bad, can loom just as large as factors further afield when it comes to Asia's economic performance and therefore our own. And in the final analysis, sensible and credible policies at home, the strength of our financial institutions, and the resilience and adaptability of the businesses and employees, all of you, actually, that make up the Australian economy, will continue to be our greatest assets. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Glenn. Simon Clifford, you touched on the strength of our financial institutions at the end there. Is there a bit of a double-edged sword in that, that we've now got a bit of an oligopoly with the banks and what they're doing with interest rates?
Well, it's certainly true, I think, that in some areas there's less competitive pressure than there was. In other areas, there's more. I think this is perhaps not widely appreciated, that the location of competition in the financial services sphere has shifted. It hasn't actually disappeared, but it's shifted from the asset side of banks' balance sheets to the liability side. In other words, there are less players, say, in the mortgage market or the business lending market than there were, and so there's less competitive pressure there. On the other side, where banks are seeking to raise deposits, and they've been seeking to get a bit of a bigger share of their lending funded from ordinary deposits as opposed to wholesale money, competition there is intense. And that actually has driven up costs of raising funds, which is one factor, not the only one, but one that contributes to the pressure on their margins and therefore their... you know, these rate rises that occasionally have happened independently of what we've done. Bear in mind, of course, that in setting our rate, we have taken account of the gap between our rate and the loan rates that everybody pays having shifted, which is why we've described a 4.5 cash rate as normal, quote-unquote, when it used to be higher than that, but the reason is that because the gaps move to the loan rates, we've got to calibrate accordingly for that. So the point is about competition. That's certainly an issue, and I think that's the reality of the global capital marketplace, because some of the players that were there wanting to compete to lend have had to pull their horns in, at least for a while. My guess is that will probably begin to ease up in the year ahead, but that's been the trend until recently. But on the other side of the balance sheet where they raised the money, the competition's actually gone up. So, you know, there's quite a complicated story there.
My name is Garo Gabriel, and my question to you, Mr. Glenn Stevens, Governor of Reserve Bank of Australia, is our current federal government spent some $300 billion getting us out of this financial crisis. Being an armchair economist, if I had $300 billion and I have about 300 people here, do you think we could have done it a little bit differently and got better value?
I'm not sure that they spent $300 billion, actually. I think the figure you are referring to is probably the one that said at one point the stock of debt on issue would reach something like $300 billion. Of course, it's not going to reach that now. It's going to reach something smaller than that because the budget's going to return to surplus sooner. You've got to keep in mind when you're interpreting that figure that the slowdown in the economy itself, independently of any decision that the government might take will slow down receipts, tax revenues. It'll also push up spending on, say, unemployment benefits. And that's automatic. That's what economists call the automatic stabilisers. And a big chunk of the run-up in the debt actually was due to that factor. And it's okay to allow that. That's the way the system is designed, and that helps to stabilise the economy. So I think it's not quite right to say that policy decisions amounted to spending $300 billion. There was certainly a substantial spend, and there's been discussion about that. The point I would make in the end, I suppose, is that, you know, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with the particular measures, and I have no, I'm not going to offer a comment on that, but the debt that we will have, the net debt of the federal government, now expected to peak at 6% of GDP. Now, in the countries of Europe I've been talking about, we're talking a 60% debt ratio would be a good one in Europe. There are countries there with 70, 80, 90, 100, 110 or more percent of GDP in debt. That's a serious problem. I don't think that one can really sustain the argument that the size of the debt stock per se that we are going to have as public debt amounts to a major drawback for the economy. That's a separate question to what you think of the particular measures, and I've got no words to add on that today.
Mr. Stevens, John Marnie, Marnie Dominic Lawyers, thanks firstly for coming to Western Sydney. My question relates to interest rates and monetary policy. Are you concerned that Australia's major banks appear to have reserved to themselves the right to interfere with monetary policy by not feeling obliged to follow movements by the RBA in the cash rate?
Well, this goes back to the answer to the first question. The thing that we're trying to achieve will work through the rates that the borrowers actually pay, and for that matter, the rates the savers get. We shouldn't forget them, because they're actually the people who are funding, ultimately, all the lending. It's their savings that are being lent. But it's the rates people pay and receive in the marketplace that we're seeking to influence. So if the gap between, you know, the mortgage rate and the cash rate alters, then we configure the cash rate differently to take account of that, and we have done. We've said this quite explicitly many times. The cash rate fell more than it would have because the margins were tending to widen, and it's risen less than it might have. And the cash rate today is actually at a level which, if you go back to previous cycles, this was the cyclical low about here. Now we're saying this is about normal, because that's configured off the actual rates that people are paying and receiving out there. So what we've done is take account of those margin changes in order to try to deliver an overall set of financial conditions in the community that we think is right for the circumstances that we face.